WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Maria Leaf. Pro-abortion protesters on the streets of D.C. last night, while a night of rage was promised once a Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade was announced, there were no reports of rioting or looting. Many businesses in the district took preemptive action and boarded up their windows. Some leftists chose to go to Justice Clarence Thomas's house to let their displeasure be heard last night instead, but police were able to keep them down the block and things remained under control. More protests are planned outside the homes of the conservative justices today. Some Democrats again calling on President Biden to expand the high court and add more liberal justices for balance. But Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee, a former Supreme Court clerk, telling Fox News at night, court packing won't work.
The whole point of the judiciary is the need for independence. You lose that independence when you pack or even threaten to pack the court.
Abortion likely to be among the topics former President Trump will talk to supporters about tonight.
Former President Trump is set to rally his base at the Adams County Fairgrounds in Mendon, in northwestern Illinois, just days before the state's primary election. Trump's rally alongside U.S. Republican Rep. Mary Miller, who's locked in a bitter primary race with another GOP incumbent, Rep. Rodney Davis, in the state's 15th district, which was redrawn by the state's Democratic-led General Assembly, and as Republicans in a six-way primary for governor also vie for the former president's endorsement. Jeff Manasso, Fox News.
With Metro taking formal control of the Phase 2 Silver Line this past week, it puts Loudoun County in the spotlight to finally join the rail system.
I have been waiting for this a long time.
Supervisor Matt Latorno cast his first vote for the Silver Line a decade ago. Now, after years of waiting, Loudoun is scrambling to prepare for its arrival.
All of our Metro service that currently goes to Reston and Wheeling, it'll be going to the stations in Loudoun County. So we need some time to actually recalibrate all that.
He's hoping the service will open this fall, but regardless, he says,
it's already been a success from the standpoint of economic development.
Several projects to surround the line are already in the works. John Matthews on WMAL and WMAL.com.
Amber Heard's lawyers beginning their appeal.
Amber Heard's attorneys were back in a Virginia court filing an appeal in this same month in which a 7-person jury ruled in favor of Johnny Depp, awarding the actor over $10 million in a defamation case that grabbed the attention of the country. Heard's main attorney was told that the actress would have to put up an $8.35 million bond with 6% interest per year for any appeal to move forward. That sum, minus the $2 million Heard won in her countersuit. Heard's attorneys have 21 days to find this money. As she has stated, the actress does not have the money to pay Depp or meet the bond. Michelle Polino, Fox News.
WMAL Sports. The Nats beat the Rangers 2-1 yesterday. They'll play again at 4:05. The O's beat the White Sox 4-1, and they'll square off again just after 2. WMAL Traffic and Weather next. WMAL Traffic and Weather. LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Good morning. On the Maryland side of the Beltway, I just looked in the cameras. Lanes are clear in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County, both on the inner loop of the Beltway and on the outer loop of the Beltway. In Montgomery County on 270 between the Beltway and Frederick, lanes are at speed northbound and southbound. Now in Prince George's County between the two Beltways on the BW Parkway and 95, you shouldn't have anything in the road that's going to slow you down northbound or southbound. And on Route 50 between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, lanes are clear east and west. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com to WMAL StormWatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny and hot on this Saturday. High temperatures around 90 degrees. I have a touch of humidity out there, but overall not too oppressive. We head later on this evening into tonight, lows back into the 60s, near 70 degrees downtown. For your Sunday, even hotter into the lower 90s. Could have the chance for a few isolated afternoon showers and storms, mainly west of I-81. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the StormWatch 7 Weather Center.
69 right now at Reagan National. I'm Maria Leaf on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Now on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday morning update. It is hour two of the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. John Gizzi joins us each week. He is the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. And John, the political story of the week and the political story of the year, the decision finally by the Supreme Court on Roe versus Wade. And where do you see this going next in terms of legislators on Capitol Hill?
All right. The ruling of the justices did what opponents of Roe v. Wade always wanted. It struck down the 49-year-old Supreme Court ruling about the right to an abortion nationwide and sent it back where the issue was before 1973, namely the states. The options left to legislators in the U.S. Senate and the House are very limited at this point. It is highly unlikely they will pass the right to choose legislation that the president called on them to enact. There just isn't the time, and there aren't the votes before November. Certainly, it will be an issue in some races, but for the most part, it's going to be decided at the state capitol rather than the U.S. Capitol, and in races for governorships, the offices of state attorney general that oversee the abortion laws, and for state legislatures, this issue will be tantamount to being the big issue at the state level. Now, I might add, the immediate effect is, again, in the states. 18 states, roughly, have trigger laws, laws against abortion that were voided by Roe v. Wade, but come back on the books automatically. The state of Michigan, for example, had very strict limits on abortions that date back to 1932. A vote in November of 1972 to weaken the limits on abortion was defeated fairly comfortably in the fall, and then 2 months later, Roe v. Wade took the issue out of state hands. So I think we will see in some of these races for governorships, as well as other state races, the abortion issue come back. At the federal level, again, the options are now limited.
We've seen the intense emotion on both sides on this topic. Take us back that 49 years, John, when Roe v. Wade was decided by the Supreme Court. What was the environment? Was it anything like it is today?
Abortion was a subject then that very few talked about. And again, it was primarily a state issue. In California, in the early 1970s, the then Governor Ronald Reagan signed the most liberal abortion law into effect. He wanted to take abortions away from the back rooms and the back alleys, and if it were legal, he felt it would at least ensure the safety of the mother. He later said he was wrong and changed his views on this issue entirely. In my home state of Connecticut, in the state of Massachusetts and elsewhere, Maryland, Oregon, abortion was being legalized already. On the other hand, other states were passing very strong laws against abortion. They were primarily in the South. Overall, 57% of the population of the United States lived under laws that banned abortion or limited it in most circumstances. 43% lived in states such as California, New York, and others that allowed abortion quite legally and quite easily. It's likely that that would be reversed. For the most part, advocates felt that, number one, abortion was being made the norm because it was being made so easy for people to obtain. On the other hand, there were those who felt that the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, which says that all laws not reserved to the federal level are handled at the state level, was being run over by the Supreme Court. One more thing. The Supreme Court's decision was pretty lopsided. The vote on Roe v. Wade at the time was 6-2, with one justice, the newest member, William Rehnquist, recusing himself from the case. In this case, of course, striking down the Dobbs decision was 6-3 under the current Supreme Court, and to overturn Roe completely, 5-4. It's interesting to note the part of John Roberts, the Chief Justice, who wanted a more centrist decision on this that would preserve Roe, but the other justices were, of course, not having it.
Politically, for the fall elections, you've got the Congress, you've got the Senate, and then, of course, you have the state elections. Does this give one side the political edge in terms of the emotion and the momentum, or is it somewhat of a draw because both sides are so intense on this?
It's pretty much of a draw. I will say my experience as a political reporter, Rick, has been that when someone loses something or feels threatened, he or she reacts far more aggressively, campaigning hard, holding candidates firmly, raising money, etc. This would favor the pro-choice faction or the pro-Roe faction. On the other hand, those who opposed Roe have been holding the March for Life every year since 1973. They have worked hard for candidates. Now they appear to have their goal. Rather than be lazy or overconfident, I'm sure they'll work for it. So I'd give a slight edge to those who lost out in the decision of the Supreme Court yesterday, but I'd say that those who won are going to fight to preserve what they've always sought and now have.
Let's turn to the primaries this week. There's been a lot of attention focused on Donald Trump's scorecard and his support of candidates. How did he fare this week?
He had a very good day in Alabama, where Katie Britt, who had his endorsement, clobbered Congressman Mo Brooks by a margin of 62-38. Brooks, as we have noted, initially had Donald Trump's endorsement. He was a key figure in the January 6th incident. And then when he said we should get the 2020 election behind us, Donald Trump unendorsed him, and he turned to Katie Britt. She was the top aide to retiring Senator Richard Shelby, got 45% of the vote in the initial race. Trump's endorsement probably helped, but it wasn't key. She was going to win anyway. In Georgia, in two districts, Trump-backed candidates went down to defeat, and the winners had more than 70% of the vote. Dr. Rich McCormick in the suburban Atlanta 7th District and businessman Mike Collins in the 10th District. Now, some are saying this was a defeat for Trump, yet the candidates who emerged triumphant, even without the former president's blessing, nonetheless declared their support with him and their agreement with him on key issues from trade to abortion to gun rights. These were strong candidates that he wouldn't endorse. Dr. McCormick nearly won the neighboring district 2 years ago. He's a physician and a Marine Corps veteran. Mike Collins, who won in the 10th district, is the son of a beloved late Congressman, Mac Collins. These were going to be hard people to beat, even with Donald Trump's endorsement.
There's always so much attention paid to the U.S. presidential election, as the president is often referred to as the leader of the world. But there is another leader of the world, and you've got some information on some possible changes at the top?
Certainly. All eyes have been increasingly on the Vatican lately and on the help of Pope Francis. There have been rumors after 9 years that he would resign, following in the footsteps of his predecessor, Pope Benedict. I spoke to a very high Vatican official on Thursday evening who told me, and I quote, "The boss's time is very limited. Given his health, he'll be in there until December at the very latest." Pope Francis, of course, has been in a wheelchair, has had difficulty walking, and had a colon removed last year. His failing health is no secret. The same source told me that the leading candidate to succeed him on the throne of St. Peter is Cardinal Peter Urdo of Bucharest, Hungary. He turned 70 years old today. He speaks 7 languages and is considered someone who respects both the progressive and the traditionalist community of the Catholic Church. Pope Francis was aligned with the progressive community and was having a bit of internecine warfare, shall we say, with traditionalist Catholics. In any event, this is the opinion of one insider who sees the cardinals, the princes of the church, up close, and it's the subject of someone whose health has been in the news lately.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. As always, John, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure and never boring these days.
7:19, Saturday morning update on WMAO. We're going to check traffic with Al BD, and then we're back with Jim Trusty. And we've got more information on that Supreme Court decision yesterday.
In D.C. on the Anacostia Freeway southbound, traffic is jammed up between Burroughs Avenue and River Terrace. On 395 and 695 in D.C., have no reports of any slowdowns. You should be at the posted speed limit there. Maryland side of the Beltway, it's clear in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County. Virginia side of the Beltway, no delays, inner loop and outer loop. Staying in Virginia on 66, eastbound and westbound, that's clear. And 95 in Virginia, no delays between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, northbound and southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny and hot on this Saturday. High temperatures around 90 degrees. I have a touch of humidity out there, but overall not too oppressive. We head later on this evening into tonight. Lows back into the 60s, near 70 degrees downtown. For your Sunday, even hotter into the lower 90s. Could have the chance for a few isolated afternoon showers and storms, mainly west of I-81. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
66 degrees in the nation's capital. It's 7:20 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty back with us. We talked to him earlier this morning and got into some of the details of the decision of the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade on Friday. And Jim, I wanted to talk to you now about your feelings on the attacks on the institution of the Supreme Court. Vicious attacks on the institution itself, vicious personal attacks on the justices, from the president down to the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker of the House, all the way down to Maxine Waters, who said, to hell with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that was quite the argument Maxine put forward. But look, it's very disappointing. It's very destructive. You know, we've got kind of the short-term concerns about literal safety of the justices. But I also have deep concerns about these political figures, people in positions of leadership, that instead of being kind of the big boy and acknowledging that this was not some unprincipled evil opinion, but Supreme Court justices doing their best to wrestle with difficult issues, they trash the court. And that sets a tone for the rest of society, including the people that are kind of the worst people to receive that message, the extremists. You know, Joe Biden used phrases like extreme ideology, un-American, cruel, in describing this ruling. He couldn't help himself but wallow in the politics of the moment and essentially try to use it as a midterm mobilizer more than anything else. And I thought, you know, real leadership, presidential leadership, would at least give some deference, some respect, some admiration even, for a court that had to wrestle with a very difficult issue. And it's just wrong. I mean, it's just wrong on so many levels for politicians to trash this court. If they took the time to read the 213-page opinion, and I'm not sure that they could all get through it, but they'd read it and they'd recognize this is bona fide, judicial, independent, apolitical thinking. They may not like the result, but it's not just some crazy opinion poll on whether people like abortion. It was very reasoned analysis by incredibly smart people.
And what about the statement from the Attorney General, Merrick Garland?
Yeah, another disappointment there. I feel like we keep coming back to that most Saturdays, Rick. You know, the Attorney General still chose to not enforce the anti-picketing law that, you know, even after we had an attempted assassination of Justice Kavanaugh. So when he says now, and Joe Biden said this as well, you know, don't be violent, don't use violence. I'm glad they said that. It could be helpful. But the proof's in the pudding. And, you know, this Attorney General, if there is violence that crosses the line, or harms anybody. You know, I want to see how aggressive they take it, because there's a lot of issues with this Department of Justice about kind of two systems, one for the political pet causes and one for folks on the other side of the aisle. So, yeah, I thought that issuing a one-page statement of essentially dissent was borderline egotistical and certainly not anything that you used to see from attorney generals. And again, no respect for that branch of government. Nothing about, you know, saying I appreciate that the justices have come up with this opinion and I respectfully disagree. Not even lip service like that, just immediately saying this is a dark day for women of America because of this conservative court. And it's hackneyed political behavior by a person who should know better.
And what about the spin from the progressive media outlets and many of the Democratic politicians who are saying that contraception and same-sex marriage and interracial marriage will be next on the hit list of the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it's very disingenuous, and that was probably the low point in my mind for what President Biden had to say yesterday. He made this comment about how, you know, what's going to be next? We might be having to worry about birth control, same-sex marriages. And he mentioned Justice Thomas, but he did so in a very oblique way that suggested to the listener that the majority was with Justice Thomas on this. Well, the reality is Thomas also wrote a concurrence, and he wrote about this issue of substantive due process under the 14th Amendment. He's kind of a loner on this for the time being. And he said, because I don't agree with the concept that there's substantive due process, that there's only procedural due process, which are kind of difficult issues, I admit, he said, I think we should consider revisiting everything that we've talked about when it comes to federal rights of privacy. So, yeah, he kind of had a different way of getting there, too. But the majority opinion expressly rejected that. They literally said this decision today is not going to have any effect on things like birth control, same-sex marriages. It's a different legal analysis, and they are not in harm's way. I don't know how they could make it any clearer. But still, the politicians, including our president, jump up and try to scare people into thinking that birth control pills are next, or same-sex marriages, or that Justice Thomas, who's married to a white woman, is somehow going to come out against interracial marriages. So it was a very unfair conflation of something that Justice Thomas mentioned, but that the majority expressly rejected. And it's amazing to me that it's getting any shelf life in the media, but, you know, they have their own interests, I suppose.
Since President Biden has been in office, there has been talk of possibly packing the Supreme Court. I guess they did a study on it. Where do you see that going in the wake of the decision yesterday?
Well, you know, the commission that he created, which was very lopsided in terms of the philosophical background of the players in it, felt like a setup at the time. You know, that everyone was anticipating Roe versus Wade might get overturned on grounds of federalism. And so they go through this exercise of making recommendations and not poo-pooing the idea of court packing. Now I could see it turning around to affirmatively pushing for something that would be outrageous, something that's been in place since the end of the Civil War, but that the Democratic politics of the moment are such where they may be willing to try to upset that apple cart. So I hope that's not where it goes, but I'm concerned that it's been on the table by design to react to this moment. And in the weeks that come, we might start hearing some serious efforts by Congress, led by Biden, to make a run at packing the court.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. And Jim, I know you've been very busy on the media this past couple of days. Anything coming up today?
Well, supposedly 10:15 with Neil Cavuto. So we'll see if they stick to the schedule, but hopefully we'll have some fun and talk about probably the same topic.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
And you too. We're coming up on 7:28, the Saturday morning update. Maria Leaf has the 7:30 news this morning. Then we're back with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland. So stick around with us on the Saturday morning update.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.
News now.
WNAL News at 7:30. Good morning. I'm Maria Lee. Pro-abortion protesters upset that Roe v. Wade has been officially overturned, taking to the streets of D.C. and around the country last night. A night of rage was promised, but it doesn't appear to have come to fruition. Thousands gathering in downtown Denver.
This is a much bigger deal and a much bigger issue than any Stanley Cup, any championship, any sports team.
This is important. This doesn't just affect women. This affects anybody in America.
Colorado previously codified the legality of abortions. More protests planned here in Washington today, including at the homes of the conservative Supreme Court justices. A confession is discovered in a notebook said to have belonged to Brian Laundry, the ex-boyfriend and Belial killer of Gabby Petito.
Brian Laundry's notebook claims he killed her in an act of mercy after she had an unexpected tragedy where she slipped and fell. So pages in a handwritten confession say he heard a splash and a scream from Gabby as they were trying to cross a stream. He said she was violently shaking and freezing cold with a bump on her head that kept getting bigger, and says Gabby allegedly begged for an end to her pain. Eventually killing her, he wrote, "I ended her life. I thought it was merciful that it is what she wanted, but I see now all the mistakes I made. I panicked. I was in shock. But from that moment, I decided took her pain away."
Fox is Ashley Strohmeyer. The notebook was found next to his body near his home in Florida. Brian Laundry committed suicide. WMAL Sports. The Nats beat the Rangers last night 2-1. They play again at 4:05. The O's beat the White Sox 4-1. And they play again just after 2. WMAL Traffic and Weather next. WMAL Traffic. Here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Good morning. In Virginia on the Beltway, no delays are being reported on the inner loop or on the outer loop. On 66 in Fairfax County, you're at speed eastbound and westbound. On 95 in Virginia, you're not tapping the brakes between the Beltway and Fredericksburg. Northbound and southbound lanes are clear of any delays. In D.C., on 295, the Anacostia Freeway, southbound traffic is jammed up between Burroughs Avenue and River Terrace, and there are no delays being reported in D.C. on 395 or 695. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny today, highs in the mid-80s to low 90s. Clear skies tonight, lows in the mid-60s. It's 66 right now in Gaithersburg, 71 at Reagan National. I'm Maria Leaf on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
7:36, Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the author of Operation Dark Heart. He is a former CIA-trained intelligence officer, and he is also the president of the London Center for Policy Research. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to join you.
The House of Representatives has passed the gun violence legislation. They passed it on Friday, and it already come out of the U.S. Senate. It's a bipartisan effort. It is expected to be signed by President Biden today. It's aimed, obviously, at mass shootings and curbing the violence from mass shootings. I know you follow gun legislation and gun control and gun owners' rights very carefully. What's your assessment of this legislation out of the House and Senate?
Well, I always try to put this in context of national security as well. So what we're seeing here is a continued effort to essentially remove or degrade law-abiding citizens from having access to weapons. And one of the things that also happened this last week was the 6-3 vote on striking down the New York Sullivan Law, which was basically the requirement that you go to the government for permission to use your right. And this is the same thing here. They're kind of retreading it a little bit, in that the big push now is these red flag laws. And for those who are not following closely, basically they're trying to encourage through funding, that is to say, the federal government's going to back up and fund local state efforts to establish laws, preventive laws, quote-unquote preventive, which basically would give individuals the right, legally, to basically make an accusation of someone who is mentally unstable or, quote-unquote, dangerous. And, boy, that last piece is the thing that has got a lot of us very concerned, is the dangerous part. Who decides who is dangerous? And what does that mean? What are the requirements? So this whole thing that they're doing now, this new law that they're about to sign, will do absolutely nothing to curtail any of the current, quote-unquote, gun crime. It's going to do something to upend a lot of the ideals, which I think many people have come to recognize that are important, especially in light of the Sullivan decision last week. So the Sullivan decision did what I think should have always been the law of the land, Rick. Basically, you or I are going to have the right to be armed where we decide we want to be armed, which I think is important. That's what happened. And the reason this is national security related, in my judgment, is because the origins of this concept, the idea of the Second Amendment, that the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. And I keep hearing from the left, just a little bit of a left turn here, that, oh, well, the founding fathers never envisioned the type of weapons we have today. Well, Rick, I would remind the folks on the left that they, back in those days, weapons weren't simply muskets, because I heard the governor of New York saying, oh, well, I wish we could go back to muskets. It's not about muskets. It's about the fact that during the time the founding fathers did the law, swords were one of the quote-unquote arms. I mean, you could walk around town with a big old sword. So the idea here is that it's not about the weapon. It's not about the technology. It's about the idea that you can protect yourself. And the greater number of people, I believe, who are legally armed, you have a greater homeland security force, reflected in the fact that we, the citizens, are the militia, if you look at the actual definitions in the Federalist Papers. So this new thing they're doing, the red flag laws, all these things, is simply circling back and going a different direction at the same thing that the Sullivan Law did, is trying to put responsibility for violence and crime of others on legal and law-abiding gun citizens. So I think we're going to see the same thing eventually happen to these new laws. We're going to spend a lot of money. This is feel-good legislation for the legislators who are trying to sign it into law. It'll do nothing to impact on crime. It'll further degrade our ability to be free citizens, able to defend ourselves, and it's just a bad idea. So.
Well, the mayor of New York said that New York would now become the Wild Wild West with the availability.
And I'm
sitting here going, it's already the Wild Wild West in New York. I mean, what are you talking about? I think the problem here is the Democrats, for some reason, don't have any desire to enforce current laws and prosecute the felons and the recidivists who actually are the ones that are doing the majority of the gun crime. You know, you saw the two El Monte police officers in California who were murdered by a guy who was out on a gun violation, out on parole with a 20-day sentence. He was a convicted felon, had a gun, wasn't supposed to, 20 days, and he's back on the street. So until somebody enforces the law, I think you're going to find more average American citizens are going, huh, if the police and the prosecutors aren't going to enforce the law, I'm going to have to protect myself. I don't understand how they don't get that.
Well, they don't want to get it. And I think that's the second point we need to make here, Rick, is that all of this gun violence, quote-unquote gun violence, is actually a progressive violence, progressive control violence, by the fact that it's located, all this massive violence is located in the progressive control cities, Chicago, New York, Baltimore, Cleveland. Every city that has the massive problem have one thing in common, and it's not the guns. It's the policies that are established to do exactly what you just said, create the conditions for chaos and sustain it, and then cloak this true, pure evil in the idea that, oh, we're simply trying to protect people. We're trying to do things to help our citizens be safe. And it's the opposite. And so the thing you just said is the fact. The fact is that if people are armed, legally armed in New York, chances are pretty good they're going to be able to shoot back, and that's going to change the dynamic. And I think that's the key. Most communities that have a large number of legal gun owners tend to have a lot less gun crime, because those criminals who are out there doing the gun crimes don't last long. And that's why in New York and Chicago, you have criminals who come in who are arrested and have three and four previous felony convictions that involve a firearm. So, yes, of course, they're criminals by definition. They're not going to follow any law. And you put them back on the street, of course they're going to offend again. So this is why they had the gun violence. It's about the criminal and the criminal justice system, or lack thereof, not the firearm.
Yeah, there's two sets of gun violence when it comes to politicians. You have the mass shootings, and you have the disturbed teenager that goes out and commits a mass shooting. That's one set of gun violence occurrences. And then you have what we just talked about, which is the recidivism and the lack of prosecution in the major
right.
urban areas. The Democrats completely ignore the urban areas, and they are pretty much, I won't say completely focused, but primarily focused on the mass shootings. And there are more
right.
people killed in Chicago in one weekend. I mean, it's crazy. And they just seem to ignore it.
Well, they ignore both. You kind of circled the square there, Rick. These individuals, these mass shootings of teenagers and other disturbed people, Rick, I can't remember one of those events where the individual who perpetrated the crime wasn't already on the radar, wasn't already in some position of being observed to be unstable, yet somehow no one acted. So I suspect strongly that red flag laws are going to do nothing to inform action against these individuals, because local law enforcement, local leaders did nothing to prevent these folks from getting weapons. So, again, you're really not creating conditions. That is, the left is not creating conditions through this new legislation to do anything to address either of those scenarios, the mentally deranged teen or individual who has access to weapons, who picks it up and does something tragic, or the inner city violence problems, which truly are horrific when to that fact, especially in the summer. You're going to see the number of people murdered every weekend over the summer as you would see in any mass shooting. And again, this is a policy decision. These left-wing politicians are making this decision in their cities to maintain the momentum of the chaos we see. And again, nothing legislatively that's being signed will do anything to stop any of it.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, host of the Thought to Action podcast. You'll find it at londoncenter.org. Tony, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care, Rick.
You betcha. 7:46, Saturday morning update. KT McFarland's next, but Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center right now.
Good morning. In D.C., on the Anacostia Freeway, southbound traffic is stop and go between Benning Road and River Terrace. No reports of any slowdowns on 395 or 695 in the district. Virginia side of the Beltway just checked out the cameras. Lanes are open on the inner loop and on the outer loop. In Fairfax County on 66, no delays being reported eastbound or westbound. On 95 in Virginia, you're not tapping the brakes. In fact, you can set your cruise control between the Beltway and Fredericksburg. Northbound and southbound lanes are clear. And now, from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny and hot on this Saturday. High temperatures around 90 degrees. I have a touch of humidity out there, but overall not too oppressive. We head later on this evening into tonight. Lows back into the 60s, near 70 degrees downtown. For your Sunday, even hotter into the lower 90s. Could have the chance for a few isolated afternoon showers and storms, mainly west of I-81. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
67 degrees at 7:47 on the Saturday morning update. 7:49, it's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler, glad that you are with us this morning. And we're always glad to welcome KT McFarland. She was President Trump's Deputy National Security Advisor. She is a board member of the American Conservative Union and author of the best-selling book, Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, good morning.
Good morning.
The beauty of having you on the show is you are able to kind of look at the really hot topics of the day and put it in a perspective that not only relates to the day, but it kind of relates to how we move forward and what happens in the future. And obviously the Supreme Court decision yesterday overturning Roe v. Wade has opened up protests and emotion and anger across the country. And if you can put this decision in perspective for us as we look at it now and we will look at it in the future.
You know, thank you for that amazingly lovely compliment. But I do think it is important to take a step back from the sort of riling emotions of the moment. And when you look at all the hot button issues over the last, let's say, 150 years, from slavery to, you know, during the Civil War, to women's suffrage, to income tax, to the Jim Crow laws in the South, to President Truman desegregating the military right after World War II, to school desegregation in the 60s, to gay rights, to gay marriage, all of these started out as very divisive and controversial issues in their own time. But a few years after these controversial decisions were taken, they were accepted as norm. I mean, nobody talks about women's suffrage right now. Nobody talks about, let's repeal the income tax. Nobody talks about, well, let's segregate the schools. Nobody worries about all these issues because within a few years, the general public has said, yeah, okay, no big deal here. Let's just move on. And more people got more rights, and the society sort of grew in a direction that the majority of the people wanted it to grow into. But abortion is the one exception. You know, it's been 50 years, and the country is as divided now, perhaps even more so because of a lot of advances in science and in medicine, that people have even more strongly held convictions than they did 50 years ago. It's more and more people, you know, there's nobody in America that doesn't have an opinion on abortion, and an opinion that was formed a long time ago. The amount of arguing that people on both sides of the issue spend of, well, what about this, what about that, can you believe in this, can you believe in that, you know, the arguments are well known to everyone in the country, the arguments on both sides, and people have already made up their minds. But we are now hearing 50 years later that we're still having a lot of Americans still have issues about this, one way or the other, good or bad. I'm not judging the merits of pro-abortion, you know, pro-choice, pro-life. Everybody's got their own arguments, but as a society, we've not made up our minds. I mean, maybe there's 1% of the people who still are in doubt and can be persuaded one way or the other, but the great majority of the American people have already made up their minds, and a lot of their decisions on these are made up of personal experience with the whole subject. But, you know, democracies, the will of the people, democracies are made for controversial things like this. We're evenly divided as a nation. Our founding fathers and the Constitution, they anticipated such division, maybe not on abortion, but on other issues. And that's why they vested the power to decide these controversial issues in the hands of the states, in the lowest level, whether what is the lowest level closest to the will of the people that can decide on these issues. And so I'm thinking that, well, you know, this is one issue that the people are going to have to decide for themselves. And once the dust settles, you know, the judges have basically said it's up to the states. And once the dust settles, the political battles will move on to the states and to the state courthouses and to the state legislatures and to the state governors. That's maybe where this goes going forward, and maybe that's where it should go. But in any event, what worries me, Rick, is that with all the violence, the increasing violence, and I do think we'll see more violence in all directions, that some crazy person is going to decide, oh, I've got the answer here. I'm going to assassinate a justice in order to give Biden an opening to appoint a different kind of justice. Mm. You know, we came within an eyelash of a sitting Supreme Court justice being assassinated. And the assassination wasn't prevented because all the great protection he had, or because, you know, the perimeter around his house was protected. It would happen because the assassin decided at the last minute to call the FBI on himself. So I really hope that Washington is going to give additional and significant security to the justices and to their families. And then when the issue gets pushed down to the states, that the states do the same. Because, again, we're evenly divided on this. Whether we should or shouldn't be is not the point. It's the fact that we are.
What about the rhetoric coming out of you know, the administration, out of the members of Congress. I mean, we saw Chuck Schumer basically threatening Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh a few months back when he was over at the Supreme Court. And we've heard a lot in the last 24 hours, Maxine Waters saying to hell with the Supreme Court. That doesn't help when it comes to the concern that you have. What do we do about that? Can somebody maybe instill a little responsibility in terms of the intensity of the rhetoric? I get the idea of getting people to the ballot box, but, you know, not to the point where you want to burn down the Supreme Court or take out a justice.
Well, the irony of this is that the Democrats in Congress are having a show trial on the January 6th actions of President Trump, and yet so they're condemning him for not pulling back his supporters and not holding him back, not coming out and saying, "Hey, guys, don't do this." They're condemning him for encouraging the people on January 6th to storm the Capitol, and at the same time, these same Democrats are mum when others are, in fact, and you could probably take it, like you've just said, that Chuck Schumer and others are kind of, by not condemning it, are encouraging it. And so I think we need responsible leaders on all sides of this issue, but particularly starting with the White House, to just come on and say, hey, wait a minute, everybody. This is not a time to destroy our institutions. This is not a time to go to war with each other. This is not a time to target people for assassination who feel differently on issues than you do. You know, so many issues of the day today, and this is what I find very upsetting in the bigger scheme of things. Everyone says, well, we're going to, like, put all the rules aside because the issue is so important. So, for example, Donald Trump, the media, what did the media say? Donald Trump is so evil that we're going to stop being a neutral observer of events, and we're going to try to shape events. The elections were so bad that we're going to somehow put aside our whole electoral process. COVID, it's so bad that we're going to take away rights from people and do things on it. Every single one of these things is designed to take away rights from the people. I'm a big believer in the people's rights, as were our founding fathers. So I would love to see our leaders of all sides of the issue do the responsible thing and maybe even come together in a press conference and say, calm down the violence. We will deal with this. We have dealt with bigger crises than this in our past. We will deal with this too, but we will not deal with it if we continue to whoop up people and resort to violence.
K.T. McFarland, the author of the bestseller, Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. K.T., thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
That's it for the Saturday morning update. The 8 o'clock news is next with Maria Leaf, and then it's Garden Sense on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.